The Brad Sesmatt Show, broadcasting live.
It's good Monday. Thanks for being with us. John Wilner from the Wilner Hotline fame, all things Pac-12 football, because it is game week. John will be joining us coming up at 10:20. Bigger news on John I'll get to in a minute, although it's big to be on the show, but there's just bigger news. There's been a lot of buzz, and I mean a lot of buzz, about the job that Claudia Faust, Devin Henry, and Jordan Spurgeon did on the Zach Hoffpower documentary that we released last week. And because those of you that have seen us do this through the years, there are times where I like to go through the process of how a story comes together. Students watch this, teachers watch this, educators watch this, people that want to be in the business watch this, just people in general that are like, how'd they come up with this? And what were the ups and the downs of putting a documentary together? How do you get three people, as Claudia, Devin, and Spurge did? I really had nothing to do with this other than I saw it initially and suggested it, took them out there, and then said, okay, Claudia, you're the EP, and Devin and Spurge, you guys, the three of you, are going to get after it and come back with it. And if you need some guidance along the way, I'm around. But it's them. It's not me. So we chopped it up. So I want to use that today on the stream show as well. Our opening comments are brought to you by Desert Financial Credit Union. Desert Financial Credit Union, taking care of you, taking care of your business. That is Desert Financial Credit Union. We appreciate their support. Had a great time at the Fiesta Bowl lunch last week with Jeff Mishi and his table, all from Desert Financial Credit Union. All right, it is football week. The Padres are in town who are desperate against the Diamondbacks. The golf yesterday was phenomenal. I found myself watching Patrick Cantlay and Bryson going back and forth. Got some thoughts on that. But it is finally college football week. The Cardinals, thankfully, mercifully, if you saw J.K. Dobbins from the Baltimore Ravens grabbing his knee, here it is. The NFL valuing their employees so much, let's put them out in harm's way for games that don't matter at all. And what happens? He grabs his knee and he's gone for the year. And the NFL is like, huh, the way it goes. So I just have such low tolerance for August fake football. So now the Cardinals get through it unscathed. They make some cuts today. They cut Keyshawn Johnson. So they... again, it's being pointed out how poor their drafting has been when it comes to just guys sticking around at the wide receiver spot in the later rounds. So now Keyshawn Johnson is latest to be tossed to the curb. And this will be the two of the three wide receivers. The only one that is left is Andy Isabella, the guy that was taken before DK Metcalf. So fans are having a field day at the Cardinals' expense on that. And it's really... really pretty simple for the Cardinals. You got it all figured out, then just go win. You don't, Cliff's going to get fired, and Kyler's going to come under siege, because that's what happens about every 3 years here in Arizona. Ta-da! It's not that hard. Now, on the college football front, before I get to Arizona State and U of A, I saw Chip Kelly smile on Saturday. That doesn't happen. You know, that's like a 70-degree high in July in Arizona. It never happens. But I saw Chip Kelly smile on camera when UCLA drilled Hawaii. I watched some of that game on Saturday. And this is a big time. I can't wait to bring John Wilner on board to talk about the game and then another thing with John that we'll get into in a moment. Because now you have UCLA and LSU this coming weekend. And to me, it doesn't matter if UCLA wins the game or UCLA ends up losing the game by a narrow margin. What UCLA cannot do is get blown out. And yes, there was nobody. The fans were introduced before the players before the UCLA-Hawaii game on Saturday. There was nobody at the Rose Bowl. And yeah, it was 100 degrees up and up. But in Los Angeles, if you're not good, you're not relevant, you've been off the radar, you can get all excited. If you're the SEC guy, yeah, what else is there to do in Tuscaloosa? I'm just waiting. What else is there to do in those small college towns? So when I ever hear that, when I hear that argument of, well, you know, look at all the fans that show up. Have you been to College Station? There's nothing for 100 miles around. And it's awesome. I'm not bagging on it. But there's nothing else going on in these college towns. There's nothing else going on in Austin, Texas. Yeah, you've got Atlanta, where the University of Georgia, where the Georgia Bulldogs are playing their games. You do. I understand that. But by and large, what else is going on in Tallahassee? What else is going on in Gainesville? What else is going on in Los Angeles? A lot. And if you're not good consistently in LA, then I'm going to go see the Dodgers play. I'm going to go to the beach. I'm going to go to the mountains. I'm going to go hang out. I'm going to go down to Rodeo Drive. I'm going to go down to the Walk of Fame. I'm going to go see movies. I'm going to take the train down to San Diego. I'm going to take a train up to San Francisco. I'm going to drive the California coast. You're in Huntsville, Alabama? I'm going to go see Alabama play football. And really, that's about it. And it's fine. It's fine. But when I get these guys that point out, do you know how many fans show up in Ames, Iowa? Yeah, it's not LA. But I'll guarantee you this, there'll be more fans there for the LSU game, and it will not be sold out. Oh my gosh, it should be sold out. And no, no. It's kind of like Arizona State. The people at ASU tell me, well, you know, this is a pro sports town. And my response to them is, well, make it a college sports town. Well, it's just never going to happen. The stadium's too big. Well, the stadium's not 73,000 anymore. Well, there's this. Well, there's that. There's always something. Always something. So here we go into the start of the season with Arizona State. If they have 30,000 real fans in the stands, butts in seats Thursday night, it'll be a win for them. They'll announce 42 or so, and that's just part of the game that is played in this day and age. Oh, my gosh, look at all the fans that showed up. And guess what? The following Saturday night when they play UNLV, there might be 45,000 fans, and they're going to, many of them are going to go down on Mill Avenue at halftime and never come back. Does it make it a bad town? No. But if you start out 3-0 by winning at BYU on national television in a game that I think that they should win if ASU has their whole squad together by game three, people that try to say this investigation is going to lead to nowhere are clearly you're on the payroll, or you just want to make sure. You want to make sure that there's nothing wrong with your little school. There's just too much out there. It's not even the envelope. Well, prove it. Okay. All right. Knock yourself out. So John Wilner, I want to get to that. John Wilner and Sports 360 AZ, it's actually John's bosses at the San Jose Mercury News. We started talking a few weeks back, and I said, you know, I really like the Wilner Hotline. It's great college football content and great college basketball content. They don't have an outlet here in Phoenix. They're in the Arizona Daily Star in Tucson. They're up in Pullman. They're in other towns in the Pac-12. But they're not here in Phoenix. And I said, so what's it going to take? And we figured something out. And John is going to join us. John actually says, I'll come on with you every week if you want, Brad, because you're a partner. It's cool. And he's great. His content is on the website if you want to check it out, sports360az.com. The Wilner Hotline is now part of what we do at Sports360AZ. We're going into our 10th year of doing this, and it's a good move. Javi Baez, thumbs down. Do you see this story? So Javi Baez gets base hit, turns to the fans who are cheering him, and he does this, thumbs down. Fans are enraged. Sandy Alderson of the Mets enraged. I don't know. I look at this story and I think, you know, Javi Baez might actually have a point. Have you gone to sporting events and heard and seen some of the things that come out of the stands? People that just, I don't know where they come from. I don't. They just feel like I have a ticket so I can be a complete a-hole. I can be something that I can say whatever I want because I'm jealous that that's him and that's not me. And so if he strikes out twice, I'm going to let him have it. So Javi Baez said, well, I'm going to get a base hit and I'm going to boo you guys. I'm going to give you thumbs down. And I think that's great. Well, the Mets don't like it because, of course, negative PR. I don't know. If you win games, all this stuff disappears. We're just filling time. Just please win. It's like the Padres in town tonight. This is a great series. I ordinarily wouldn't even acknowledge the Diamondbacks towards the end of August because they're so far off the radar. But here they are in a role to play of spoiler. The Padres put all this money into Machado and Tatis. And right now they're on the outside of the playoffs looking in, or close to it. I didn't check this morning, but close to it. And so if the Diamondbacks can just muster it up, just sack it up, and go take two of three and send a message. You know, we haven't rolled over for our manager. This is a big series. These are the types of series, like what they did. They lost three or four in Philly. Who cares? You come back home, there'll be few and there'll be, I don't know, a couple thousand people there. They'll announce 17, 18, whatever. Game will get a few ratings points. It's fine. But you could really do some damage to the Padres, and like you did a couple weeks ago when you're out in San Diego. So looking forward to that. And then there's Bryson DeChambeau, and they'll take a break. I know I'm running along, Jared, but and I have some news on Jared and I, too, that I have to share. So yesterday at the BMW Championships, you have Bryson DeChambeau and you have Patrick Cantlay, and they're going back and forth. And Bryson tells Cantlay, what was the exact quote? I wrote it down here. Patrick, can you keep walking? Because he was walking slow. Can you speed up? Kind of woke Patrick Cantlay up, I think. Bryson didn't talk afterwards. They go into a six-hole playoff. They played 24 holes of golf yesterday. And these are the two top guys this year. And Bryson keeps jerking putts. And I've found myself rooting for Cantlay. I've actually found it's kind of like Tiger and Phil, although I've never sat there in Tiger and Phil in their heyday. It wasn't, I'm a Phil guy, I'm a Tiger guy. Like Bryson hits the ball so far, but yesterday it was, oh, it just was. Is he going to do this to me? Oh, you're so mean. You're mean media guy. It's true. He's going to be on the Ryder Cup here in a few weeks. Like, how's that going to work? And so, you know, when I see a great moment, and it was like an hour yesterday of these two going back and forth, and the announcers were losing their minds. Paul Azinger called Bryson on the air the big bad bully after he lost. I'm sure there's a phone call coming from an agent on that one. But that was terrific to watch. Now it's Patty Ice, new nickname for Patrick Cantlay. All right. I wonder if they get Cantlay and Bryson here at the Open. That would just be, that'd be so good. All right. Let's take a break here. Oh, the thing on Jared and I. So we haven't been together in a few days. Last Thursday night at 6:30 p.m., the Emmy Awards were announced, the Emmy nominees. And our little company, our little slice of heaven, has three on staff that were nominated for Emmy Awards. You have Jordan Spurgeon, you have Devin Henry, and myself. Now, all of us are the people that you see, but without Jared Nielsen capturing Tom Brenneman's interview with me last January, I believe, and I was very pleased to see Jared's name show up on the screen because he's as much a part of this as me. And so we got nominated. We'll find out in November. It's an excuse for Jared to wear a tux, for me to wear a tux, or if we have to do it virtually, and for Devin to wear a tux, although it's the same weekend as NASCAR, he pointed out to me, and for Spurge. So it'll be fun. So good job there by Iron Man. All right, next, it is John Wilner from the Wilner Hotline. That is on the other side, and then our Chop It Up on our documentary. I'm Brad Sussmat. All right, as promised, as I mentioned in the last segment, it's so exciting to have John Wilner's content as part of Sports 360 AZ. And it's not just for us. It's just because John does really good work. And in this day and age where our industry, this is a bit of a rant here for me as a sometimes Cronkite instructor and just mentoring kids through the years, our industry is under siege. So whenever I see somebody who's really good at what they do And it's, well, what if we gave them distribution in Arizona? And what if we put them on a television show that's in all of Arizona, all of New Mexico and lower Nevada, even though there's not a Pac-12 footprint there? Let's just give John some more space because he's everywhere, except in our great state, because I hear, well, Brad, you guys are all about pro sports. Well, no, that's not the case. We've been doing college here since 2012. All right. So with that as a long-winded setup for John Wilner, you can read his content on the website. But of course, you can follow him over on Twitter and social media, Wilner Hotline. It is good to see you. It is great to have you on board, John. Thanks.
Thanks, Brad. Good to see you. Thanks a ton for the partnership. Really appreciate it.
All right. So let's get through this week. And I'm not even going to start with Arizona State or U of A. I just want to go down the idea from your view of how important is it for UCLA to show well against LSU versus winning? Because in front of fans and friends and family, I think the PA announcer introduced the fans before the players in the UCLA yeah. Hawaii game last Saturday. How important is this primetime national matchup for the conference for UCLA just to show well?
You know, I think it's a big deal. LSU is expected to bring about 20,000 fans. So the bar for UCLA is 21,000. And we'll see if they can get there, you know. it's tough. You know, you guys have it in Arizona too, right? The early season games in the heat, mm-hmm. it can be very difficult for the fans. You know, I think it's important. I don't think you can necessarily separate. Certainly it's going to help Chip Kelly keep his job if they can win. Right. But I think it's hard to separate the UCLA LSU game from what's coming the following week, right? Mm. September 11th is Colorado against Texas A&M, mm-hmm. Washington at Michigan, Oregon at Ohio State. You add UCLA, LSU, and those are four monumental games for the conference in an 8-day span. And certainly it would help if UCLA were to win, keep it close. But, you know, when you look at that collective, it's really incumbent upon the Pac-12 to win a couple of those games at least. Right. And if you don't, if you're the Pac-12 and you kind of get blitzed in those four, then the ceiling at the end of the season is a lot lower because you got a much tougher chance of much more difficult chance of sending your champion to the playoff. If in all your high profile early season games, you know, you're getting run off the field. So, you know, I would say I look at UCLA LSU as part of that quartet of games over that 8-day span.
And I look at Stanford because they have the toughest schedule in the nation. And David Shaw spoke about this at Media Day about being forced to do the 9 a.m. kickoff. Now, he's not big on that. And I know it's Kansas State, but it is, again, a national audience that is going to see them at 9 in the morning. If they get blitzed and it's the middle of the day, it's all day and all night of saying, man, the Pac-12. And the same for Oregon State, Purdue. It's in. I thought Oregon State finished the season well. If you parse back what they did last season, John, they had some close games and they beat Oregon. So it's not just the marquee ones, but I think for the conference, and I agree with you about September 11th, it's these next 2 weeks then of, look, we're not the joke of a conference that people make us out to be nationally.
No, absolutely. You're right. Those are important games against Big 12 and Big 10 opponents, you know, and the USC and Stanford games against Notre Dame too. You could roll them all up and just say they kind of, it's just one giant opportunity. Mm-hmm. For the Pac-12 to kind of change the national narrative, right? I mean, it's been, what, 5 years since there was a playoff team? And part of the problem in that stretch isn't just that the Pac-12 has been left out of the playoff. It's that it hasn't even really contended, right? So you get to November, and that is the month for college football, right? The World Series is over. Yep. NFL playoffs haven't started. NBA is just getting rolling. November is college football month, and too many times the Pac-12 has been completely off the radar in the playoff conversation. It's not like it's contending even for the number five or six spots. It's no different than Conference USA when you talk about the playoff in November, and that is what really needs to change. The conference has got to be part of that conversation through that entire month where all eyes – you know, hardcore college football fans and also just mainstream sports fans are paying attention to college football. Pac-12 has got to be in that conversation. And every one of these games against Power Five opponents matters to that end.
John Wilner with us, the Wilner Hotline. You can check out his content on the website at sports360az.com. And of course, you can follow John on Twitter if you haven't done it. A great follow at Wilner Hotline. Outside of those games where they are against Power Fives, you do have games that everybody looks at USC and says, okay, is he about to get run? He better push through. And here's San Jose State that had a great season last year. I know it was Southern Utah over the weekend, but they disposed of them as they should. Intriguing game there. And then you have Oregon with a new quarterback with Tyler Shuck moving on. Actually, the Brown ascends the starter. And they're in a spot against Fresno State. Either one of those games catch your eye for any reason?
Well, I mean, I think you could argue that they're both kind of trap games, right? I mean, Oregon, it's going to be hard for those guys to not be peeking ahead to the trip to Ohio State next week, right? And Fresno and San Jose State are – both Pac-12 teams are in a little bit vulnerable situation because they haven't played yet. Mm-hmm. They haven't had a chance to work out those jitters and all the kinks that come up, you know, when you haven't been on the field. Meanwhile, Fresno and San Jose State both did play and both won in, you know, confidence boosting fashion. So those teams are going to have, you know, they're going to work through all the issues that you get the first time on the field. And I think that that adds to, you know, the vulnerability that Oregon and USC both have. At the same time, that component works to UCLA's favor because they've played. LSU not only has not played yet, but is dealing with the hurricane and having to relocate the practices and then make the trip out. So, you know, you can never kind of overlook that piece of it early in the season when you've got a team that has played a game against a team that's on the field for the first time. And USC and Oregon are both vulnerable because of that.
Who's the coach that's got to get it done? Is it just pointing squarely at USC and saying, this is it or else? Or do you look around the conference and say, Brad, you know what? There might be a little bit of pressure coming here if things don't turn.
I guess it depends on whether you're talking about on the field or off, because there's two coaches that I think have a lot of pressure to win on the field and two that have off the field issues, right? You know, Chip Kelly and Clay Helton both, I think, are, you know, in must win mode to keep their jobs. Now, I think the bar is probably a little different it's probably a little higher for Helton than it is for Kelly. I think if Chip gets UCLA, you know, to 7-5 in a bowl game, he'll probably be okay.
John, he was smiling last week.
Yeah, I know.
I saw Chip smile.
Like, I know.
What is this?
Well, I think he knows he's got a good team.
Yeah.
They got a lot of veterans. Yeah. A lot of veterans and they got a good defense and a good offensive line. So and he also is in a good position because they're kind of getting overlooked a little bit. So his guys are hungry. Whereas, you know, Helton, I don't know, 7-5 is not going to probably do it for him, but is 9-3, maybe, but it depends if they get blitzed by Notre Dame, you know. Right. So I think that those two coaches are in the most jeopardy in terms of performance. Herm Edwards and Nick Rolovich, for different reasons, have got some serious off-the-field issues that, you know, could end up in them not being their team's coaches by the end of the season.
John Wilner with us. Let's focus in on Herm. I'm of the opinion that either way, Herm won't be here next year. If they have a great season, Herm Edwards doesn't need to go out and deal with transfer portal and all the stuff that's happened off the field and NIL and all of that stuff. If he does not win, there's going to be a change. He's 17-13. And the fan base down here, the big cigars, I call them the alums, they notice 17-13. 70-7 over a bad U of A team, which might have been the worst team that U of A has ever had at the end under Sumlin. That carries a little bit of weight with some, but not with the guys that write the biggest checks down here. Would you agree with that assessment that either way, ASU has a new coach in all likelihood? I'll put that in parentheses next year.
Yeah, I think that's the smart money is certainly on a change, right? I mean, he doesn't have, you know, they win. He doesn't have anything to prove. He's accomplished what he needed to accomplish. They lose. You know, they probably want to make a change. The NCAA, either way, you kind of wonder if the NCAA issues are also just going to lead to Herm saying, I don't need this anymore. Whether his reputation is intact or in tatters at the end of this whole thing. What's he, 66, 67? You know, he's certainly this was never going to be a long-term deal anyhow, right? No. I mean, it's not like when they hired him, they were expecting, you know, a 10-year commitment. This was more of a short-term deal to get the program up to the next level. But the issue too, though, is, okay, who's the successor, right? Because I know he wanted Antonio Pierce to be the successor, but I think that certainly is in doubt at this point.
Yeah, there's no way I can see that happening down here.
Yep.
With everything that's going on. He was the co-coach. What yeah. AP says is what I say. I've heard that come from the coach's office in the past. So Jed Fish, it leads me over, and we'll finish up here. I look at where, and I said it earlier, Kevin Sumlin ran that thing into the ground, and I've been to Tucson a few times to watch what they do and to see how he comports himself. Both these quarterbacks he's going to go with, Gunner and Plummer, our kids are right here in my own backyard, two Valley kids. And so the buzz is really good. There's a good vibe. The high school coaches here in Arizona care more and like more what's going on in Tucson than they do what's going on at Arizona State, because ASU's model is national. So with that as a backdrop, I guess it's if they don't win against BYU, and no one's expecting them to win the game down here, it's how do you go about building week by week? That's where they're at right now from my view. What about you?
You know, I think if you're an Arizona fan, especially if you're an Arizona fan who was skeptical when they hired Jed Fish, right? Maybe you wanted Brent Brennan. You wanted somebody who's got ties to the program, and then they go ahead and hire Jed Fish with no ties. You got to be impressed, right? He has made all the right moves so far, you know, with it, whether it's recruiting, re-recruiting play, his own players who were in the transfer portal, community outreach, enthusiasm, culture. All that stuff has gone as well as you could have hoped.
Assistant coaching staff that's really good and engaged.
Staff, yes, absolutely. Now it's just a matter of can they win games? Can he coach, you know, game day? Can they prepare properly during the week? And I think that we're going to see an immediate bounce. I would think that Arizona is going to win a couple of games this year. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I actually think they could beat BYU. BYU's got a new quarterback, and this is, to me, this is a, you know, Arizona's going to be very, very energized for that game. The question I have is whether Fish, not whether he can get him back to, say, 4-8, 5-7 on a regular basis, some level of respectability compared to what it was under Sumlin, but can they get up to 8 wins, and can they win 8 consistently, you know, or a cycle of 7-8-9? That's a much tougher deal, and that has been a very difficult task for Arizona over the decades, right?
I think there's the off-the-field stuff that I look at. When Rich Rod was in his final season here, they approached 28,000, from what I was told, in season ticket sales. Under Sumlin, they were under 9,000 at the end. There was the story last week. Dave Hickey came out and talked about how the athletic department is in debt. I think it was $6 million. Some had reported it to be higher than that. So is there patience? That stadium is in a tough spot to remodel and refurbish, just the way that it's located in the middle of the campus. And so is it just, and it's not really the basketball school it once was. I think the coaching move needed to happen over on that front. So there is this window right now, John, to your point, of if you can come in and capture the imagination of a school that is in a bit of a turmoil, I would say, between those two programs, he might be the right guy at the right time. Might be a bolt of lightning.
He might be. I mean, it certainly was a risk, right? I mean,
sure.
I've looked at this, you know, for across the conference in football and men's basketball, and there are not many instances where you hire someone who has never been a head coach and also has no ties to your program, right? Either they've won somewhere else as a head coach, or you know, they were an assistant coach. They played for you. They understand what works at that particular school. Fish and Tommy Lloyd both don't qualify, right? Neither has been a head coach before. Neither has any ties to Arizona. So that's an elevated level of risk, I think, with both hires. But they, I don't know that Arizona's really got a choice with Fish, but, you know, to stick with him for three, four years, right? The president is so heavily invested in that hire. The situation with the budget is very difficult, and they've made some nice upgrades to those facilities, but that, you know, that west side of the stadium is, like you said, that thing is a beast, and that's going to be $150, $200 million, right? And that's That is a next level. They need that for the long-term success of the program, but that's it's just going to be such a difficult task.
Yeah, and I just hope Jed, I don't think he's under any pressure at all. Like you said, the administration needs to roll with him. I just hope he's not like many coaches I've come in contact with through the years here, where they start banging their head against the wall saying same old thing. That's my
right.
thought.
Well, it could be. That's up to the administration and the president. I mean, Robert Robbins is all in with this, and he has got to – I mean, I think to some degree his job's on the line with Jed Fish, right?
No
because
question. No
there was
question.
So much community resistance to an outsider, and he went ahead and did it, and he did it despite, I think, what some of the big donors wanted. And so he's on the line. So he's got to do whatever it takes to help that support the football program with resources.
John Wilner, you can read his content over on the website at sports360az.com. Make sure you follow him on Wilner Hotline. He's 24/7, 365. He's one of these guys who just does it. He's 10 cups of coffee 24 hours a day, it seems like, with the content. Good seeing you, John.
Literally. Thanks. 10 cups of coffee. Yes.
There you go. There's John Wilner. We're back with more after this timeout. All right, so I want to take a deep dive. Whenever we do a doc, I like doing the decompression of the documentary, because for what all of you just saw or saw earlier, you're about to see, when it comes to the life of Zach Hoffpower, it was a process to put it all together. And the three that are here in this screen are the ones that said, let's get after it and let's make it happen. So Claudia and Devin and Spurge, if you don't know Claudia Faust, this is like the Brady Bunch. You guys are in each corner, or you may rearrange it. I don't know. Devin Henry and Jordan Spurgeon, they're the three that said, let's get after this and make it happen. Claudia, you were given the EPI, said, you know, let's put this together. So I want to back up to this doc came together on Zach Hoffpower with Eric Sorensen calling me and saying, hey, a little birdie told me Christian McCaffrey is going to be in town. You should follow up on it. And, you know, why? I had no idea. So I followed up on it and got connected to Kim Freed, who is someone that you did not see in this documentary, who put me in touch with this event that was being put together. I then turned around and went to Claudia and Devin and Spurge and said, there's a cool event coming up. It was May 15th. I went back, looked through my notes, May 15th. And I picked up Spurge and I picked up Claudia, and Devin met us there. It was at CCV out in Peoria. And this is the way documentaries go. It's just, there is no formula. It's not like here, it's handed to you. You've got to piece it together. And so I want to pick up the story from there. And let's go with you first, Claudia. So when I pitched you the idea, and then that night, did you see this coming together the way that it did?
100%. I will say at first, I kind of didn't know what we were getting into, but I think that was kind of the beauty of it. The event was really awesome. It was Zach's mom put on an event kind of to raise awareness about the Zach Hoffpower Project, which she's working on. It'll essentially down the line help college athletes kind of with life after college, or if they're struggling with mental health, to get them connected to the right people.
Like Zach was.
Exactly. I was like really emotional the whole event. I did cry a few times. Mm-hmm. And I think all of us, if you either weren't crying, I'm a very emotional person. So like, as soon as it started, I knew it was going to happen, but I think everyone had it in them. I just kind of let it all out. There were also things I kind of related to that she had talked about that Zach went through or his friends, but it really started to come together. And I think all of us just kind of, I think we had a moment where we looked at each other and we were like, this is going to be something good. Mostly just to spread awareness. We thought immediately that was the route we were going to go. Christian McCaffrey, having him there was obviously awesome, but I think we also kind of looked at each other and we're like, it's cool that he's there, but clearly the story is about someone else. And when you've got someone like Christian McCaffrey there and you're saying that, that's how you know it's a good story.
Yeah, I mean, and Devin and Spurge, just jump in here, interrupt, interject. This is free flowing. You know, Devin, you met us over there. What do you remember about that night?
I remember thinking, you know, we might have like a cool little documentary about awareness, like, I don't know, 10 minutes, you know, be done like in the next month or two, and then summer, and then high school football again, right? And I think that after watching the event and being there, we filmed probably a couple hours of footage, and I don't, there was a little bit of Todd Graham and a little bit of Christian McCaffrey. Most of what we filmed there wasn't even in the documentary because, like Claudia said, we had no idea what we were getting into in terms of how massive this outreach was and how many people Zach touched throughout his only 26 years of life. So that was a day where I knew that there was something definitely special that was happening with many, many people, that it went beyond the Phoenix area, the Peoria area. And then we come to learn it was much larger than Arizona as well. And, you know, you go home that night and you're just kind of processing everything. And I'm just thinking, there's so much more to this story that we didn't even comprehend that night. And I went home knowing like there's more to what we just saw, I think. And I'm really happy that we were able to get, I think, most of that more out there for awareness of what Zach went through.
Spurge, this was your first doc, right?
Yeah, this was the first one.
And so the night that night, you and Claudia and I are driving back, and I think I asked you guys, what do you think? We're just pulling out, so what do you think? And what did you think that night? I don't remember what you said, but can you think back to, you're pulling out of there and it's your first time out. What struck you most, and did you see what ended up being the finished project?
Yeah, that night, there was so much. I mean, I know it started with, I think our original idea was you were going to interview McCaffrey. We had all our cameras. We were going to help you out with that. We get there and it's, oh, hey, Christian's just not really in the mood for that. Let's not do it. And so we were kind of thinking, okay, well, what do we have here? And there was something kind of telling me like, okay, this is still like a really cool event. Let's just see what we have. And as soon as they started talking and I kind of looked around the room for a second, I realized that Zach touched a lot of lives. So immediately I was like, this kid impacted so many people. I don't know the full story. I don't know how he died. I don't know. Like, I barely knew that he went to Stanford at that point. It was just kind of, I knew this kid was somebody that had done a lot just from hearing people speak. So that night it was just the whole car ride. I think we were talking about it, and it was just about processing sort of how we tell that and kind of share a story. And I think at one time we thought, okay, maybe this is a 7-10 minute doc. And like, as soon as we said that, we were like, no, this is a full TV show as a doc. Like, we knew right away in the car, we're like, this is a full TV show as a doc. I don't know if Devin knew that exactly because we were in a separate car. I'm assuming Devin did, but I know the three of us have talked about it. And we're like, yeah, this is something we can do. And it's going to be a really good story.
Could you guys have done 42 minutes? Meaning an hour. For the audience that's watching this, 42 is an hour.
You know, 100%.
Yeah.
So what got left out? What got left out?
I feel like there was a lot left out. I feel like one of the unfortunate things we didn't get to touch on was kind of the lighter stuff. Cause like Zach definitely had this like infectious personality. Like when people talked about them, like they talked about him with so much love. By the end of this, truthfully, with the number of people we talked to, I had told this to his parents. Like, I feel like I got to know him through this documentary, and the only fear that I have is that not everyone will, because they didn't spend hours and hours and hours talking to friends and family like we did.
How many people total? How many people total? How many hours of tape?
So the three of us spoke with Doug and Shannon, his parents, and then separately, just because of different locations, I had Zoomed with Ronnie, who went to Stanford, with Ronnie Harris, who went to Stanford with Zach, and with Dr. McKee in Boston. So four total, but that obviously doesn't include the people like Christian McCaffrey, who spoke at the event, that we did get to include. There's way more. Sorry. Todd Graham, which the three of us were there for that. And then Spurge and I were lucky enough to chat with, Coach Shaw when we went to the Pac-12 conference. So six people, if my math is correct, which I cannot always be trusted with my math. So it might not be. So you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I think six people total. And everyone had such great things to say about him. And I think given the extra time, you would really get to know his personality outside of his mental struggle. Obviously, that was the point we wanted to get across, because I think that there's a lot more athletes that deal with it. And with the CTE findings, which was a surprise for everybody involved, because his dad had just gotten the results back right when we were essentially starting interviewing with him. It was like that week. So I that's the part that kind of stinks. I really wish everyone got to know every part of Zach, but in 21 minutes, you can't touch on 26 years of life of one person. So I think we did the best we could given the timeline, but I think if we had 41 minutes, like, people would really know Zach.
And I would go even further because I know all three of us agree that there was not enough dancing in this documentary, because that is what Zach was all about. And he really, his emotion and the way that he has that personality, it infects you through dance essentially. And everyone, it doesn't matter who we talk to, because you have Claudia Six. Then we had the incredible podcast with Jordan Simone and Zach, to be able to have Zach kind of tell part of his story through first person, which you don't get on a documentary like this very many times. And then you have other family members who were around while we were doing the interviews with Doug and Shannon, who, you know, have the same kind of stories here and there. So I agree with Claudia. I wish that we could have, if you didn't figure out who Zach was as a person, or even if you did, there's so many more layers to what he did. And even athletically, we didn't go over that he started on the varsity basketball team as a freshman. He went into high school not playing any of those three sports. He was a soccer player. So there's a lot of aspects, both personally and athletically, that just didn't connect to what we wanted to make sure got out there. The awareness of what Zach was going through, the reason why, and hopefully a thing here and there that people can pick up on and go, okay, maybe I have some sort of mild brain something from playing football 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. I have similar symptoms potentially. Now this is maybe a new route that I can get to like how Zach said, I never felt normal, or how Doug said, Zach said that he never really felt normal. There's people across the world who feel like that and don't even understand that it's head related. So to me, that was one of the biggest things that I wanted out of this documentary, was for people to understand, you know, maybe this is something that they need to look into personally.
I think the biggest thing that I had to cut, for those that watched it on TV, you had basically three blocks. That's how I broke it up for the TV show, and it kind of flowed in the web doc. So the A block was more so a slight story, kind of what happened. You get to the end of his life and passing away. The B block was more so the actual story of what happened, the CTE, the mental health. And then the C block, which was the final one, was more light. It was more so the impact on young people. And there were probably 30, 40 stories that we got of Zach from parents, from friends, from coaches. And there were so many cool stories that we couldn't really include because of time. I think one was, and this would have made the ASU decision make more sense, the battle between ASU and Stanford. Shannon had met with Coach Graham in Michael Crow's office, and Shannon ripped Michael Crow a new one because she was saying, this school is so great. Why have I never heard of any of these things going on here? I've always thought of ASU as a party school. But there were so many great academic things that she really liked and that Zach really liked as he was getting to know Todd Graham. And they just had a story because Todd Graham was telling us, you know, when she did that, he was scared. He'd only been at ASU for 2 weeks. And this mom of a recruit is over here yelling at Michael Crow about how there's no messaging out for the school. And it scared him. And he really liked that. And so there were stories like that that we never really got to share in the doc that really helped like explain situations and then explain like who Zach was even more.
And it was funny because the first interview we did was with Todd Graham, and we kind of knew that story, and we brought it up, and Todd was like, oh yeah, I remember being in that room and it was uncomfortable. So that was one story that was really funny. And then something that I'm surprised that our recruiting expert, Jordan Hamm, hasn't said something about is the fact that Zach was committed to Cal. Mm-hmm. At the start of all this, he was committed to Cal, thought that the coaching staff was going to be fired that next year, decommitted, and that's when the Stanford versus ASU stuff started. So there's a lot of different stories of Zach and what he went through in a lot of different ways that we unfortunately weren't able to squeeze into those 21 minutes.
Claudia, you're the one that sat with both the mom and dad, correct?
Well, we were all there, but yeah, I kind of led the interview process.
Devin and Spurred shot. They had cameras, right? Particularly yes. And so you're sitting with Shannon, and I had sent you over a message from her preaching on Mother's Day. And I said, you know, so here's kind of the background. And it was very emotional, very powerful. But when you sat with her, it wasn't as, what's the right phrase for it? When you sat with her versus for the first time to try to get her to open up, it wasn't that easy, right?
I think that she had been burnt out from talking about it so much. We basically talked to her pretty shortly after that event. I think she made it clear that she had been very emotional lately because it was just after 1 year of him having passed away. I think that she was just exhausted from it, which I can't even imagine. I can't even put myself in her shoes because I'm not a parent, but I couldn't imagine what she'd been going through. I think that she was exhausted and kind of burnt out about it. But I think as we got to talking with her, she realized that we really cared and that we really wanted to tell the right story. I think there might have been some fear there about, okay, here's another media outlet that might potentially get the story wrong, because the first time anyone heard about Zach Hoffpower passing away, it was a drug overdose. But obviously now we know there's more to it than that. It was not purposeful. It was not an accidental overdose. You know, it was just a kid trying to sleep. And if you haven't seen it yet, you'll find that out.
It sinks at the end.
Yeah.
Just kind of threw it away, but.
Yeah, it's all right. Sorry.
It's all right. That's fine.
But I think that she realized that we really were there to tell people who Zach was. And I can quick get into that too, but I got some really nice texts from some of the family and stuff. She was kind of the one I most wanted to hear from just because I knew she had this fear about it. And she messaged me and said, "That made me so emotional. You did an amazing job. You guys did Zachary right. I look forward to working with you again. Thank you so much for handling the most important thing in my life with such class." Hmm. And that's the first time that Jordan and Devin are hearing that. But that like really meant a lot to me. I'd been in communication with Doug a lot, especially in like the final weeks as I was still collecting photos and stuff. And he was also very pleased, said to thank everyone involved. I got texts from Ronnie Harris saying, "Thank you. That was so amazing. Thanks for involving me in it." Kim Freed said, the one who kind of connected the story together for us. Let's see. "I just watched the piece. It was so, so well done. You knocked it out of the park, Claudia, and everyone else. Every word was meaningful. Thank you." And then I, you know, of course, said that we all really cared about it and were just so happy that the people involved really loved it as much as we did, because we poured a lot of work into it. I had family members reach out to me and some people on Instagram and stuff, friends of his. Yeah, so yeah. It's made an impact.
Yeah. What if you didn't get Dr. McKee?
That would have been really tough, which there was some time where I wasn't quite sure it was going to work out, just getting on Zoom, because we kind of, we're doing a documentary, we need the visual, but everything kind of worked out like last second almost with her.
Who helped on that? Who connected that? Was it Doug? Was it Shannon? Who? How did you get the doctor and the powerful, powerful words and the results? Because that's really what is the story behind the story of all this.
Yeah. So I texted Doug and kind of like re-asked him after a little while, like, is there any way I could get connected? And I think it took emailing five people to like actually get to the doctor. I emailed like the PR girl at Boston University, and then it was like another PR girl. And then it was someone else in the CTE clinic there. And I just somehow eventually ended up with a direct email to Dr. McKee and quick set up an interview. And I kind of kept it simple because I'm not an expert and most people watching are not an expert. So at first I was like, how am I going to prepare for this interview about brains? Like, I don't know how to ask questions about the brain. And then I kind of thought, well, viewers aren't going to know what to ask in this situation anyways. They want to know what I want to know. And I needed to ask it simply. So it was kind of just getting to know the symptoms and validate everything that Zach was going through and how that connected to actually being diagnosed with CTE after he passed. It really all came together and made a lot of sense. And just the severity of it and how rare it is for someone with, I don't want to say as little, because obviously he had a very successful career, but he did have a fairly short career in sports and football and baseball. I mean, as I think Spurge was saying, he had started much later in life with all of these sports, yet he had stage 2 CTE, which a part I didn't include, but Dr. McKee compared it to almost the amount of CTE that Aaron Hernandez had. He had stage 3, but they were kind of borderline. So she compared it very closely to how progressed his CTE was, which that really hit home for me because I watched the documentary on him. And I would say personality traits were a lot different between the two, but still a lot of these symptoms were prevalent in both. They just kind of appeared in different ways, with both of them, but it kind of really stressed the severity of it and validated the mental health struggles he was having.
Devin, when she got the doctor, do you remember talking, and Spurge, jump in on this too, because you guys had to pivot a little bit, I would think. I don't know, full disclosure, I said, here's the story, go. And every now and then I would check in, but these three were dialed in. The last thing they need is somebody standing over the top of them and saying, where are we out here? Where are we out here? I mean, there were some deadlines, but Devin, I'll throw it to you and Jern, if you want to jump in on this. When she got the doctor, what did you think? Like, okay, we have to go a different direction? Or is like, cool, great, let's just keep moving forward.
Yeah, that was the last missing piece. We had the ability to talk to a coach who we didn't have coach him, who we still had a great connection with. We had his actual football coach. We had a teammate. We had the parents. We had himself on Jordan Simone's podcast. The only element that we were missing was the scientific and the mental part of what actually happened. So we were, to an extent, preparing for what if we do not get the doctor, because, you know, you never know. I know that this doctor in particular has done a lot of CTE research and PR stuff as well. I mean, she's went out and talked and she's been quoted a ton of times. If you just go look on Twitter and search her name, Dr. McKee is all over CTE, but you never know what's going on in her life. Does she want to be on camera in the first place? Are they too busy? What's the red tape looking like? Is she allowed to talk about everything? So if not, we were kind of prepared to, okay, we need to pivot and go to either just some other mental health specialist or expert to talk about what actually happened. We knew that we needed to tell the story of what happened in here, because that was the bulk of the problems and the difficulties that he had from Stanford on. So we had to find a way to say that beyond just the parents, because Doug and Shannon did a tremendous amount of research into what was going on with Zach before they actually went to some of the doctors, such as Chris McCaffrey sent him to. They did their own research on what they were trying to do to help Zach as much as they can. But when you have an actual expert and doctor talk about it, it's completely different. So we needed that element in some way or form. But when Claudia texted us, hey, I got the doctor, it was a sigh of relief, because we knew we had the final piece of the puzzle to properly tell Zach's story.
Yeah, because that took a while to get. I remember we interviewed Doug first and did that, and we kind of were like, okay, we're going to need a doctor. And then we talked to Shannon, same thing. We were like, all right, that's like the next thing we need. We need to get the doctor. We need to get the brain scans. And so Claudia was awesome. She was able to get Dr. McKee, and then she had to stay on her for the brain scans too. It was a loophole. I know you probably know more about it than I do at this point, Claudia, but it was a loophole to get those released. They hadn't been released yet. And I think we got them like less than a week before the doc aired.
Yeah, it was a couple days before. And it was kind of one of those things when Brad had texted me like, hey, did you get them? And she'd kind of been telling me like, it's not going to be what you think it is. And then I got them and I was like, yeah, okay. It's not, without explanation, you don't really know what you're looking at. So we have his exact scans, but without having his name on it or like it being circled or, you know, showing specifically where the CTE is, you could kind of guess like the red spots and stuff, but wasn't super clear. We included it, but it wasn't very clear what it was. So I think at the end of the day, the most important thing we thought we were going after was the brain scans, but the doctor was way more important.
You guys have to talk each other off the ledge at any point in this, because this is not, hey, 9 to 5. Hey, it's 5 o'clock.
I wish it was some days.
Yeah. I think we were saying before this, like I had like four, like 15 hour days in a row, like the last week where I was like laying, you know, cutting things from different sections and putting things together and laying B-roll. And then it was kind of like, I got a little bit of a break because Spurge and Devin are like so amazing on the technical side. They helped obviously a ton with the storytelling, but I kind of finalized that. But they got in and like the editing that went into this was incredible. Spurge did an awesome job kind of showing, he calls them audiograms. I'm guessing that's what they're actually called. But where you see the parts where on the podcast, you have the waveforms and he had the pictures in the background. And Devin did so much audio editing just so everything sounded really clear, picture editing and fading everything. And like that, like, thank goodness for you two, because I would have had 10 more 15-hour days if I didn't have you guys, especially for that part. But as a whole, I think the only time we talked each other off a ledge was just go take a break, which I think we all said to each other at some point. But we really were the best team. Like, I don't think there was ever a time where we weren't on the same page, at times like texting the same thing at the same time. Like, really, really awesome team to work with.
And I mean, it'd be 10:30 at night, and it was more than a week before the doc was even due, but it'd be like 10:30 at night. We're like texting things to each other, still all in the same project together, looking at things. But, and I look back, Claudia complimented me and Jordan. So now I need to go to compliment Claudia, because back when we did the interviews, I like to think of myself as a good interviewer, good on air host, things like that. But when Claudia was interviewing most everyone, and me and Jordan would jump in occasionally too, but she's asking these questions and I'm like, man, I'm glad she's here. Cause I mean, Claudia like did a great job like knowing what? The questions. Like it's what, just Devin?
Give me an example.
Follow-ups are so difficult. Yeah. Because on one hand, you have your piece of paper of, this is what I need to find out. I need this sound. I need you to say, or not say these things, to answer these things so that we have the answers from the source. But it doesn't matter what journalism class that you take. Everyone knows that the only thing more important than the question is the follow-up. The issue is not everyone knows how to follow up or doesn't know the right thing to ask afterwards. And so Claudia did a phenomenal job taking, I mean, there were almost like these half-hour tangents where Claudia is like, I found a rabbit hole, and just boom, that direction. And it was all phenomenal stuff. And it helped open up the interviewees to kind of be more comfortable with us. Because again, I at least hope it seemed like we cared, because we legitimately did, about Zach's story. And Claudia did a phenomenal job going off script for, I don't know, 70% of the interviews, which were like an hour and a half long. So
we were there for a long time for both parent interviews. I think we got to the point where Shannon had like an appointment and had no idea we were going to be there for like 2 hours, and we're apologizing and like getting our things out the door as she's getting out the door and getting her daughter in the car. And it was, I mean, hours long for those interviews.
When you finished, I know that we're all remote. Did you guys do a group hug? Did you guys high five? When it was sent, did you just all go ahead and go, wow, this is something?
I took the biggest Nextel of my life. I think when it went live, I was sitting here with a bowl of cereal on my computer, and it was just a giant exhale. And we were just texting like, wow, we did it. And there were certain spots that were literally put in like that morning that Devin had added in. You can explain what those were, Devin. But I was like, oh my gosh, those look so good. Like, I barely like saw that, because they literally got added in last minute. And like, it was just like a huge relief.
I think I was texting that. Well, I think we texted so much. Like, I have texted you two more than I've texted my fiance in like 3 years.
Wow.
Just because of how much, we don't text that much, but you know what I'm saying. We were texting day in and day out, basically. And like that morning, Brad, you asked me how I was feeling about like, oh, it's going to air today. And then like that last hour, I texted Devin and Spurge, and I was like, I get a lot of anxiety when I go to the airport, and I feel like I'm going to the airport right now. Like, it was the same anxiety. Yeah. And I was like, just waiting for like takeoff, basically. And it was like identical to that feeling. And then once it aired, I think I jumped up and down like on my couch. I was like, oh my gosh, like it's happening. And I think we breathed like 10 sighs of relief, though, because there were several times where we thought we were done and then we weren't. And so I think we did that a few times, but every time we were like at like a huge milestone, we were like, great job. Good job, everyone. Mm-hmm.
And I think the figurative group hug was not until 5:30, because I mean, so for those of you who don't know, I help deliver the TV show on a weekly basis. And it's one of those things where like, I try to Hawkeye every single thing that I do, make sure everything is right. And I don't feel comfortable until it plays and someone tells me like, yeah, it was all good. And there was a point in the documentary, which I like full truth here, I did not watch the documentary when it went live. I didn't want to. I was like, I have to push this aside. I went and did something else. And Claudia and Jordan and I are still texting each other. And Claudia sends this text. Oh my gosh, did we take out this part? And I was like, we better not taking out that part. Did you not see it? So I was kind of having my own freak out. Just like, oh no, it's right here. I was like, Claudia, don't do that to me. Like, I get legitimately concerned sometimes because I'm like, until the show is uploaded, because it uploaded, because there's issues on the upload site at 10 that morning is when it finally got uploaded to the Bally's delivery service. And so until it's done, like,
yeah,
I don't breathe yet. And then I think we had that figurative group hug once it got over. And Claudia even texted us and was like, no one's texted me anything. Should I be concerned? Or like, it's like 5:35. And she's like, has anyone texted me yet? No one's texted me.
Yeah. But then I got them eventually. I think Devin said like, they're probably taking it all in. And then each text I got was like, I just needed some time to like take it in. And I was like, okay, word for word, what Devin said.
Okay. So last question as we chop it up on the documentary, what did you learn that you want to take next? This is more of a question for people that want to do docs or people that want to know the process of doing a doc. So what'd you take away from this? It's like, okay, next time I do one of these, I want to do this.
That's super tough. I think we were, Jordan and I were talking about this before the two of you got on, but like, it's almost going to be hard to top, which I'm not saying we can't, but I think we were all so connected with it. And so all I could hope for is that we have another story in the future that we can really connect with and like show that we care about. Cause I think it's like when you connect with the story and like you really want to get it right, then you put everything into it. Like my heart was set on getting this right, like for the family primarily. Like at the end of the day, if everyone hated it and his parents loved it, like that's what mattered to me. And I think in the future, that's what it's going to be about for me, is like making sure I'm getting the story right and connecting with it. And I think that's what it comes down to. Every story I've ever been like extremely passionate about, it's because of like a connection I formed with it.
And I want to go back to the team aspect, Brad. I forgot to mention this. What you see on your screen right now, there are no egos. No egos to be found right here. Negative egos at the very least. Sometimes my head is a little big. No, I'm kidding. But we all had no ego and a common goal of telling Zach's story to the best of our abilities and correctly. And I think that those two things in particular, plus the work ethic of everyone else on the screen as well, contributed to what was a tremendous showcase of Zach's story. And quite frankly, well, what the three of us are capable of doing together, apparently. But to the point of making a documentary, it's like I've done three documentaries now, Too Many Docs, and this one, obviously, with Sports 360 AZ. And all three of them were completely different. One, I filmed all on my own with a DSLR. It was my first shoot with a DSLR, like, for something continuous, a long-form story. And that was completely different than going and doing the Armani Williams piece last year. And that piece was, like, a day, like we had no storyboard, and we spent, like, 3 months working on this. I had, like, 10 hours. I got you everything that I need in 10 hours and make a documentary. So, and then this is, we almost had no original B-roll, I think, in this. It was everything from other people who were willing enough to help us out and contribute to that and get like Zach's photos and stuff. So every piece that I've done so far has been very uniquely different. And so I think that when you go into a documentary, first of all, you have to be open to whatever comes through those doors, you know, because you might get a lot of B-roll. You might have no B-roll. You might have good audio. You might have terrible audio. So you just have to take what you get. Don't force anything, you know, and then just cumulatively grab everything, go, what can I do with what I have?
Where'd you get the final word?
Yeah, that was all great stuff that I agree with things being different and kind of feeding off that last point, Devin. I've heard this with people on different documentaries all the time. Oh yeah, this one thing that you really loved. Yeah, that happened like 2 days before. And that was basically this. I think we had pretty much all of the sound laid out for the most part by the Sunday before it aired. So a little over a week before it aired. And in my head, I was getting really anxious about how are we going to visually make this work now? Because we were in the house and we shot things and, you know, we had the photos on the floor and used the camera to get some cool shots and things like that. But there was nothing where I was like, okay, this is going to be hard. So it's not just talking heads the whole time. And luckily, we just had the right people. Brian Small, who was Doug's roommate in college, had that 42-minute and a 15-minute like video collage of all those photos that we were able to use. And then you set us up with Rich Reed at Cox, who they dropped a documentary last week on your view about high school football that I watched that made me anxious about visuals because they had 40 years of logged footage they use. And I was like, wow, they have so much footage that must have made it so much like easier and more fun to put together because of that. And so they were able to get us some footage of Zach. So that was really helpful. And so definitely the thing that I will know is always reach out to everybody you can for footage as early as you can, because for documentaries, that's a big part of it. I also would have people on FaceTime that are really close to me, and I would just listen to it. And I was like, does it make sense when you just listen to it? And then I'd have them watch it with almost no audio. Does that still make sense? Because it was something I learned at Palomar Community College, which Brad and I are alums of. Go Comets.
Yep.
It was, all right, if you watch it without listening, does it make sense? If you listen to it without watching, does it make sense? If both do, you did a pretty good job. And so I had that going on. And so, but getting the visuals right and getting like all that resources tapped into you, into us was a lot of help.
Well done by all three. If you've not seen the documentary on Zach Hoffpower, it is up on the website. It's great chopping it up.